Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Marriage and monogamy.
97% of mammals do not pair up to rear their young. We do. It's a hallmark. Monogamy is a hallmark of the human animal.
Today I met the boy I'm gonna marry.
Most human beings everywhere in the world form a pair bond with one person at a time. Monogamy.
Our guest is Helen Fisher from Rutgers University.
You can feel deep attachment to a long-term partner while you feel intense romantic love for somebody else.
Is there any good reason why marriage has to be monogamous?
Well, every society has all kinds of rules about who you can copulate with and who you can't. I think actually one of the very first rules that humankind invented were rules of sexuality. We're a jealous animal.
Today.
Marriage and monogamy, coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, it migrates to the air via the signals of this radio station and our ever-growing number of affiliates, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and also now you can download our podcast from our website so you can listen anywhere, anytime.
Well, Ken, today we're going to talk about monogamy. Monogamy means literally one spouse per spouse or something like that. What's philosophical about monogamy? When I ask myself that question, I say, well, any word can lead to a little bit of philosophy because we can start by discussing what the word means. Now, what does monogamous mean? Is it a biological concept? We say wolves are monogamous. They don't have church. They don't have weddings. They don't have steeples. We say Utah wasn't monogamous. That means their law allowed polygamy. Is it a legal concept or a biological concept?
It's not an either-or question. It's both. I mean, we differ from many species in nature in forming monogamous, long-term monogamous relationships, and lifelong monogamous relationships even. I mean, many species don't do that. So there must be something peculiar about our biology that makes it the case that we do that, something about evolution that explains that, and that's biological. But then there's all this cultural stuff, you know, the songs we sing in praise of love and monogamy and all that stuff, you know? I mean, so it's biological, it's cultural, it's legal, it's a many-faceted thing.
Probably it has many, many meanings in another sense. It's one of those concepts that brings a lot of things together that could be separated. For example, if we think of the British nobility, at least in the old days, they used to have all these children out of wedlock. Well, that kind of says two different things. On the one hand, it's a monogamous concept because they weren't allowed to have a lot of wives, so if it wasn't the wife, it was out of wedlock. On the other hand, the implication that there's no sexual activity outside of marriage is undermined. So what does it mean?
So you're raising an interesting point. I mean, monogamy, we say they're in a monogamous relationship. Well, they're in a relationship that's supposed to be monogamous, and then there is this urge to wander, to seek adventure and variety, and lots of us do that. And, you know, some things in our culture actually say, seek variety, you know, make love to whatever moves, now, with more possibilities. Some things in our culture say that. Some things in our culture say, be faithful to the one true love. Some of us would like to have it both ways. Some people, I'm going to exclude myself here, some people would like to have it both ways.
It kind of depends on whether you think by our culture something like Sunday school or whether you think something like the movies we go see. Like, what was it, 30-year-old or 40-year-old virgin.
Yeah.
I didn't get a strong sense of monogamy coming out of that as a cultural norm.
That's true. But as I say, some people want to have it both ways. And our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, met a couple that is trying to have it both ways. She files this report.
For some marriages, two people just aren't enough. These spouses share their partners in swing clubs or lifestyle clubs.
You and me, no matter how they toss the dice, it had to be.
What I tell people is go to your favorite mall, look around. Those are the people that you'll see at a swing club. They range from laborers to venture capitalists.
People who swing typically do it once in a while. It's something they just kind of get in the mood for and they say, oh, let's go to a club, you know, like going out dancing. Lifestyle is just what it says. This is what we do for recreation. Also, a lot of our friends are in the lifestyle. When we got married 2 years ago, most of our wedding party were lifestyle friends. Yeah, we'd have sex with them, and we still do.
We differentiate the world between horizontal friends, those are the ones we have sex with, and vertical friends, like you. And most of my vertical friends know that I'm in the lifestyle. My parents and my sister do not know. They would be disapproving. My son doesn't know, but that's only because he's not old enough to have asked the right questions. So when he's ready to ask the right questions, he'll get the answers.
Well, I feel like I'm monogamous with Brian. We don't do this separately. That's just something we found that we prefer to do, is to stay together. I love watching Brian with another woman. We share everything. We share, oh, look at that lady going down the street. We don't have to be afraid of each other getting upset.
Cheating is having sex with someone else without your partner's knowledge and approval. That's cheating. We don't cheat. The first time that she and I were in a sixsome and she was with another guy, you know, I felt some real twinges. That night, I forced myself to tell her that I felt that. And she said, well, I kind of felt that when you were with the other woman, too. And it led to a lot of discussion. To be successful in the lifestyle, you have to communicate. It really strengthens the relationship because you talk about all of the issues that come up. And what it does is it gives you skill and practice in talking with each other that transfers over to all of other life's issues.
I think for me, jealousy came up in the beginning of our relationship quite a bit just because we didn't have a strong foundation yet. And as I look back now, it was my insecurity about myself and the newness of the relationship, not knowing where it was going to go. And that happens in any relationship.
Some of the hottest sex we have is after we've been at good parties. It's like everybody else we've played with is foreplay. And then we get back together and you not only have the physical stuff, you have all that emotional connection. After good parties, it's like really hot.
I'm Christian. I don't consider myself a sinner. I mean, we're all sinners as far as I'm concerned. But because Brian and I do this above board and we do this as a couple, I can't see that there's anything wrong with it. We do it as part of the marriage.
We'll never get divorced. No matter what comes up, we have the tools to discuss it and take action to fix it. We're together for life. There's no question in either of our minds.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that interesting, indeed somewhat fascinating, roving philosophical reporter piece. I'm John Perry, and with me is my vertical co-host, Ken Taylor.
Definitely vertical, John. We're joined today by Helen Fisher, a noted anthropologist. She's a research professor in the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University, author of the widely read book, Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love. Helen, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Hi, Helen. John Perry. Welcome. The folks in Polly Stryker's piece, which we just heard, seem to have taken something to the extreme, perhaps. But many people really want to have it both ways. They want committed, monogamous relationships, but they want variety and adventure in their sexual life. Can the resources of biology or anthropology help us understand why human beings ended up in a situation where they have these two strong tendencies?
Very definitely. I think we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is the sex drive, the craving for sexual gratification. The second is romantic love, that elation and obsessive thinking and focused attention of very early intense love. And the third is attachment, that sense of calm and security that you can feel with a long-term partner. And as it turns out, these three brain systems, they often interact with each other, but they can act separately. You can feel deep attachment to a long-term partner while you feel intense romantic love for somebody else, while you feel the sex drive for a whole range of other people. And so there's some people in the lifestyle, as you say, as they say, who want to keep that deep, long-term attachment to their partner and also have an extremely active sex life with a range of people. And so they've worked it out for themselves to do that.
Well, now, the subtitle of your book is The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Loves. Now, when you say romantic love, Is that just a very vague expression, or are you speaking of a certain specific kind of a part of the ordinary marriage or love span, particularly intense? Or what do you mean by romantic love?
Well, I've looked at the last 25 years of psychological literature and culled from that literature the basic characteristics of romantic love. I've also read poetry from cultures around the world as old as 4,000 years ago to certainly modern hunters and gatherers who've left songs and myths and legends. And everywhere in the world, people describe romantic love. And it has many characteristics. The first thing that happens when you fall in love is a person takes on special meaning. As one man said to me, he said, the world had a new center, and that center was Marianne. Then you focus on this person. You can list what you don't like about them, but then you sweep that aside and focus on what you do. You feel intense energy. That's from dopamine activity in the brain. Elation when things are going well. Mood swings into despair when things are going poorly. A real dependence on this person. Intense craving to be with them. Motivation to win them. And more than any other characteristic, obsessively thinking about them. They obsessively think about them day and night. So I came to believe, because of this set of characteristics, that romantic love, a very specific brain, was a specific brain system, and that it would be associated with elevated activity of dopamine and norepinephrine, natural stimulants in the brain, and low levels of serotonin, which would give you that obsessive thinking. So I looked for that with my colleagues and actually found some of that brain circuitry.
That's fascinating, Colin. But I want to ask you, I'm going to take you back a step to this. You said evolution evolved three systems in us. There was the attachment thing, the basic sexual drive. There was a third one. I can't remember.
Romantic love.
Romantic love. Now, but why didn't it make it? I mean, it seems like that's fine if each one works in its proper place. But when you attach to someone, why the devil doesn't the other one turn off? Because now it's getting in the way. It's like you've got these competing things in you, right? It just, I mean, it seems like evolution wasn't a grand designer.
Well, actually, evolution... I don't think we evolved to be happy. I think we basically evolved to reproduce. And the happiness we sort of try to take some responsibility on for ourselves. But anyway, I think that these systems evolved to not turn off, as you say, for very good Darwinian evolutionary reasons. Let's go back 1 million years or 2 million years. If a man formed a pair bond with a woman, had that brain circuitry for attachment, formed that pair bond, had two children with her, loved her deeply, but also went over the hill occasionally when he went hunting, slept with some other woman, and by chance just had two extra babies, he would double the number of genes that he spread into the future. So those men who were adulterous tended to have more babies and pass on this appetite for adultery.
That explains why it doesn't turn off in men. Does the same thing happen with women, or is the physiology, psychology of women just completely different from men's?
You know, that's such a wonderful question. So many of my colleagues believe that men are much more adulterous than women, but I keep on saying, who are all these men sleeping with? I mean, you know, when there's a man who's sleeping around, and I think there's good Darwinian, I'm not defending adultery, by the way, it's very painful, but simply trying to understand it. And, you know, 1 million years ago, if a woman had a husband and two children and occasionally had an extra lover, they call them EPCs, extra pair copulations. And she
that
might
sounds
have an
so
extra...
clinical.
I know. They must, you know, she might have had another child, maybe a child with better genes or different genes. Or she would have had an insurance policy. If her husband died, this other man might step in. And she would probably collect extra resources for the children that she already had. So adultery for women had reproductive payoffs as it did for men. And we selected in the human brain for both a tremendous drive to fall in love and pair up and rear our children as a team, and also a nagging tendency for adultery. And that can certainly lead to divorce.
So just tell me how you understand the word monogamy. Is monogamy mean this kind of long-term pairing that's consistent with what our swinging friends on Polly's Peace engage in, or what your caveman did over the hill? Or is monogamy mean no sex outside of what was it, EPS, extra pair?
Extra pair copulation,
yes,
EPCs. mono means one and gammy means spouse. So one spouse. And if you were to go around the world and just simply count the heads in teepees and tenements and igloos and everywhere in the world, you would find that most human beings everywhere in the world form a pair bond with one person at a time, monogamy. 84% of human cultures permit a man to have several wives at once, but you've got to be rich in order to talk to women into sharing you. So the world tends to be monogamous, and I've looked in 40 societies, and people are adulterous as well.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is monogamy. Our guest is Helen Fisher from Rutgers University.
We've been talking about the biological bases of monogamy and infidelity. In our next segment, we'll ask whether ever-increasing lifespans and ever-increasing opportunities for infidelity have rendered monogamy an outmoded cultural norm. Do you have something to add to the discussion? You can join by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Monogamy, cultural ideals versus biological reality, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Disparage, ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary.
Serial monogamous Frank Sinatra and Love and Marriage. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, lifelong monogamist. Today we're discussing marriage and monogamy with noted anthropologist Helen Fisher. Look, we have biology and culture. They seem to be at war. Biology says variety, excitement. Culture says one woman, one man, forever. Can they go together? Tell us what you think.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And if you're outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. That's toll free. Finally, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest, Helen Fisher from Rutgers University. Helen, look, lust and love, they kind of war with each other. And mostly they kind of war at the biological level. They kind of fight to a draw. Lust sometimes wins out. Love wins out other times. But, you know, overall, it's maybe a draw. But at the cultural level, love is the winner by a long, pretty long shot, at least in what we call the above ground culture. We extol the virtues of lifelong love, of deep romantic love, of fidelity and all that stuff. We hardly ever extol the virtues of cheating and adultery. Although there's lots of things in the below ground culture that says, you know, make love to whatever move. Why are culture and biology so out of sync?
Well, I think that in our modern society, I mean, we come from an agrarian tradition, and for 10,000 years, we were farmers. And you know, on the farm, you really needed a lifelong partner to help you with all the farm duties. And the real lifelong pair bonding, you know, divorce was not allowed in many cultures around the world. You know, if you go back to hunting and gathering societies where women are extremely economically powerful, they commute to work to do their gathering of vegetables, to come home with 60 to 80% of the evening meal, are just as economically, socially, and sexually powerful as men, women tend to have between 2 and 3 husbands during the course of their life. So we're probably an animal that is capable of a lot of things. Some people form lifelong pair bonds and say it's quite easy. Other people really struggle with it. Some people form a series of pair bond relationships, and they're all different adaptive mechanisms for different human beings.
So biologically, we're kind of polymorphous in some sense, right? But culturally, I mean, there aren't very many cultures that extol the virtues of loving and leaving. I mean, our official culture is, you know, the wonders of adultery, the wonders of deserting your wife and children. I mean, there aren't very many. Why doesn't culture reflect the biological kind of polymorphism of our sexual urges and desires?
Well, Ken, I wonder if you've been going to the same movies all your life
that I have been.
I mean, An Affair to Remember and, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin and, you know, from the 30s until the
60s.
They used to have a thing in Hollywood to keep those movies from...
That's true. And I say pop culture, there's an explosion of this in the last 40 years, especially, right, since the, quote, sexual revolution. But kind of so-called high culture and the official sanctions of law and our official institutions, they don't reflect this.
Well, every society has all kinds of rules about who you can copulate with and who you can't because, I mean, you know, raging rampant copulation with whole groups of people without any kind of institutional grip on them is probably not conducive to well-ordered civilization. So I think actually one of the very first rules that humankind invented were rules of sexuality because that's important. I mean, you know, who you... have sex with is who you're going to bear babies with, and that's how you pass your DNA into tomorrow. So this would be just exactly the kind of human behavior that would be most likely to have imposed on it a great many rules, our rules are changing, though. It's really interesting how we're beginning to overlook adultery more and more. As women become more economically powerful and express their sexuality, people are divorcing when there's adultery. They don't overlook it the way they used to.
Well, it was interesting. Our roving philosophical reporter, the woman swinger in that, said she was a committed Christian. But boy, you read the prohibitions against adultery in the Old Testament and what's supposed to be done about it. It's pretty frightening.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And David in Redwood City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David. Are you there, David? We seem to have lost David. Carl in San Francisco. Carl, well, somehow the callers are dropping like flies.
Did I say something wrong?
Yeah, I don't know. Somehow the callers are dropping like flies. But Helen, I want to ask you about a psychological question. You said the rules are changing, you know,
right.
and who you can copy, who you can sleep with and all that. That's all changing. It's all variable. But, you know, there's still this thing. Even adultery still hurts people. Here's a kind of philosophical question. Why do we care so much about who our mates sleep with? I mean, if I have multiple children, I love them all equally. My love for the next one doesn't diminish my love for the first one, or so we like to tell ourselves. Why can't my lovers be like that? Why can't my love for my next lover not diminish my love for my first lover?
I think that actually for a good Darwinian reason, you know, although these three different brain systems, lust, romantic love, and attachment, are different brain systems, they can trigger each other. You can go to bed with somebody who's just a casual date, casual sex, and then fall deeply in love with them. And once you fall in love with somebody, then you become possessive. Then you're likely to leave your wife. Then you're likely to abandon various children to make new children with another partner. Romantic love is a much more powerful brain system than the sex drive. I mean, if you ask somebody to go to bed with you and they say no thank you, you don't kill yourself or kill somebody else. But a great many people around the world create crimes of passion after they've fallen in love and they've been rejected. So we're a jealous animal. The people in the swingers that you were talking to, and by the way, that was a wonderful piece. I mean, they caught exactly what swinging is. These people try not to fall in love with the people they're sleeping with. That's why they go irregularly. That's why they go only in order to come back and renew their own relationship. And so they try to stay away from the dangers of falling in love with somebody. But, you know, there's another type of lifestyle out there called polyamory, and that's many loves. And these people believe they definitely, just like the swingers, they want to sustain that long-term attachment to a really important partner, but they want to fall in love with other partners. Not have sex with that as well, but fall in love with. That's harder.
Yeah.
Those people spend hours every week just dealing with jealousy.
Yeah. Our phone system is working again, folks, so you can give us a call at 415-841-4134, and John in San Francisco's on the line, and I'm told he's really on the line, right, John?
I am.
Okay, take it away.
Cool. So I'm enjoying the program. I'm married and monogamous, which works great for me, but I was in many relationships for many years where that was not so great. And one of the main things that kept me that way was just guilt and the feeling that we had to be that way. That was just the normal way. And I can't help thinking that a lot of the cultural impetus for monogamy has to do with just the advantages of the institutions that rule our culture having that control over us. I mean, the church for millennia, you know, whether it was Islamic or the old Catholic Church or whatever, you know, was very repressive about sex, and it could take advantage of that. You know, you slept around on your wife, and then you would confess and pay extra tithes to the church to make up for it. Or you have all these sexually repressed young men who don't want to get married yet, and so they don't do anything, but they're very eager to go march off to war or something because they've just got all of that sexual energy that's not being expressed. Where I think if we just had a culture where it was like, when you know it's time, then you make that decision, but maybe, you know, it doesn't have to be this serial monogamy, I must be doing this all the time, or else I'm misbehaving. I think it'd be a lot healthier culture.
John, thanks for the call. Helen, do you want to comment on that? He said a lot
I think
there.
It's a... There's an awful lot there, and I think it's all absolutely correct. I mean, I think that all kinds of cultural institutions attempt to tap in on sexual energy and sort of almost steal it away for their particular purposes. And, you know, even in hunting and gathering societies, there's a lot of taboos against having sex before you go to war or before you go out on any kind of raid. So, you know, all kinds of societies try to tap in on this intense energy for their own purposes.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Valerie from way down in L.A. is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Valerie.
Hi, thank you. I have a general question just about the evolutionary biology of all of this. I'm not sure exactly what my question is, but I have heard reports about sort of chimpanzees versus bonobo apes having very different sexual behaviors, and how much we know about sort of where we started as a species on these questions, and then where we've come from there.
Valerie, we've got the right person to answer your question. Helen, take it away. Thanks for the question, Valerie.
It's a wonderful question because these are our closest relatives, and both bonobos and common chimpanzees do not form pair bonds to rear their young. 97% of mammals do not pair up to rear their young. We do. It's a hallmark. Monogamy is a hallmark of the human animal. And so the question becomes why. So actually I've written 4 books to try to explain this, but my basic theory is that it's not a theory that the trees were disappearing. We know that. But our ancestors came down out of the trees. They were forced to. They began to stand up on 2 feet instead of 4 in order to carry fruits and vegetables and small mammals back to a place where they could eat unmolested by predators. And with the beginning of carrying came walking. And as far as 4 or 5 million years ago, I don't see how an ancient woman could have carried the equivalent of a 20-pound bowling ball in one arm and sticks and stones in another and protected herself. So I think this brain system for attachment and actually for romantic love began to evolve so that our forebears began to focus their attention on one another and pair up to rear their children as a team.
But Helen, that sounds so, I gotta say, it sounds so, in a way, disappointing. All this complicated psychology, right? All these feelings of betrayal and jealousy and all this stuff when somebody cheats on you. All these complicated cultural arrangements. All that's just rooted in our need to carry the stuff from here to there. I mean, jeepers, that's amazing.
Well,
I start to wonder, gosh, we don't live like that anymore, so why should I care? Why shouldn't I get over these old archaic cultural formations, these old archaic psychological tendencies?
See, Helen, Ken's a philosopher, so he wants it to be something like a categorical imperative, a few axioms, a few theorems, and then we got to be monogamous. And if you can't have that, what the hell with it, you know? Yeah.
Well, we can have all of the above. I mean, there's biological reasons that things evolved, but why we do them today, we have drives. I mean, romantic love is a drive. Attachment is a drive. We probably have real tendencies towards adultery and divorce, but we have all kinds of psychological explanations as well as biological explanations.
Well, let me ask you this: is it true that wolves are monogamous, and if so,
yes,
why? Because they don't walk upright.
For the same reason that we do, they have very infantile babies that need a great deal of care, and the female needs to stay in the den to raise them. And if she stays in the den to raise them for the several weeks that she needs to, she can't feed herself, so she needs a male to help her and her young. Same thing with foxes. Same thing with all of the birds. There's something like over 9,000 species of birds. And, you know, that female robin in the spring, she's got to sit on those eggs. She'll starve to death. And she needs a mate to help her rear her young. So when you go through nature, you find those species that are monogamous. They're monogamous for economic, really, ecological reasons. It's a very odd strategy. But, you know, we're beginning to find the genetics of it. We are beginning to know the genetics of pair bonding.
You make males sound a little bit like a footnote, right? So if the female needs help, we end up monogamous.
No.
I don't mind being a footnote. That's a very scholarly place to be.
On this point, you know, there are more kinds of relationships than between men and women. And Shisa in San Francisco has a point on just this topic, I think. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Shisa.
Hi, it's Shessa.
Shessa, okay.
Thank you.
All I see is the word. I'm sorry.
I question the pairing of heterosexuals as the example for evolutionary efficiency when you have lionesses who kind of pair up with their other sisters and such, then there's the possibility of also pairing up with a stray female, not very often, I admit, but stray females. What would you say about homosexuality in evolution and philosophically the stereotypes of gay and lesbian lifestyles?
Well, first of all, you find homosexuality throughout the animal kingdom. So, excuse me, it's not just human beings. There are some homosexual gorillas and chimpanzees and cats and even dogs and birds, etc. So it is a question of how this could have evolved, because if these individuals don't have any children, their genes are going to die out. But just to start out, something like 40% of women who are gay actually have married and had a child, and something like 20% of men who are gay have had a child. So in other words, that it's possible to pass on your genes. But the current belief is that, you know, we share our genes with our sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles, etc. And if a person is gay and don't have children of their own and expend their life energy, at least in part, helping the DNA of their family members, they're also helping the probability of some of those individuals having children who tend to be gay also. So that tends to be the Darwinian explanation of this.
So I'm going to challenge a little bit. You offer Darwinian explanations, of which I'm a fan. But, you know, there's other stuff. There's our visions of a good life. What would be a good way to live? What would be human flourishing? And can't we think of reasons for monogamy that aren't connected to these evolutionary imperatives, but are connected to our kind of contingent conception of what a well-lived human life is, you know? A life lived with a person who's deeply, intimately connected to you is a way of flourishing as a human being.
We're just talking about different levels of explanation. I mean, the reason we're carrying around in our heads this brain system for deep attachment to a partner evolved millions of years ago. It doesn't mean that that brain system can't be used for all kinds of other alternatives, and indeed it does. You know, most things that are really powerful part of an animal evolve for many reasons.
Yeah.
But, there's a certain kind of shrimp that forms pair bonds. They're monogamous. They're not discussing the value of it. You know, in other words, we're talking on different levels. There can always be a biological level that doesn't negate the spiritual, the psychological, the economic. I mean, two people pairing up is a good economic unit. It works in society as a social unit. So there's all kinds of mechanisms working on this basic brain system.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing marriage and monogamy with noted anthropologist Helen Fisher from Rutgers University.
We've been examining potential conflicts between biology and culture. In our next segment, we'll ask whether monogamy has a future in the modern age. Can monogamy thrive in an age in which we live longer, love longer, in which opportunities for variety and adventure are greater? Should monogamy thrive in such a setting?
Monogamy, the modern age, and more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Bill Withers and Grover Washington, just the two of us. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Today we're discussing marriage and monogamy with Helen Fisher. What do you think about the future of monogamy? Does it have one? Tell us what you think. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And you can also email us anywhere in the world. Hit that comments button. Lots of buttons on our website, so make sure you hit the comments button. Comments at philosophytalk.org.
So, Helen, you've told us a lot about why we kind of have the psychological and sexual tendencies that we do from an evolutionary perspective. And you talked about life on the savannah long ago. But you know what? And we've talked a little bit about this. Life isn't very much like it was on the savannah. We live a lot longer. We don't live in these tiny communities. We meet more and more people. We're more often over that hill. I mean, you can be over that hill that you talked about just via the internet, you know, and meet that person online. Can Can monogamy survive in an age so radically different from the age in which we were evolved, and should it? I mean, is it an outmoded ideal?
Well, actually, I think that we're moving forward to the kind of lifestyle that we actually had a million years ago. And I think that far from being... But, you know, these are basic brain systems. They don't come out of the cortex or even the limbic system with the emotions. They come out of the motor of the mind. They're not going to be selected against rapidly. So we're going to continue to fall in love a million years ago from now and feel deep attachment. But I think in many... I'm an optimist. I think in many ways it's going to get better. First of all, both men and women are marrying later. And I've looked at patterns of divorce in 58 societies through the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations. And the later you marry, the more likely you are to stay married. We also, women are more interesting than they've ever been. They're educated now. They're in the job force. They're bringing money into the home. They're bringing ideas into the home. And not only are we marrying later, but we're having this very extended middle age. You know, they're now saying that middle age should be regarded as up to age 85 because most people in that highest age category have nothing really wrong with them. So if you can find the right person sometime in your late 20s or 30s, I think we've got a great many tools for the making of long marriages.
Well, I'm glad to hear I'm middle-aged, but please don't tell the theaters I go to because I'm enjoying the senior discount, too. Now, these three systems, the lust, attachment, and romantic, I mean, that's a really powerful way of looking at it. And I would say it seems to me in our society today, people have kind of learned to put on the brakes when they have the lust and the romantic going together. They may pair up, but they really let that wear out before they decide to get married. I mean, they're kind of, it's as if there's been a cultural a bit of knowledge gained that lust and romance are very powerful, but maybe you ought to wait before you make a lifelong commitment. I mean, that's what it seems to me the biggest difference between the generation that grows up now and what grew up 40 years ago when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. It's probably a good idea because, you know, when you're madly in love with, I mean, you know, Chaucer said love is blind and love is blind. I mean, you know, before I put all these madly in love people into a functional MRI brain scanner to study the brain circuitry of romantic love, I would ask them a lot of questions. And one of the questions was, what do you not like about your partner? And they could list what they didn't like, but they would sweep that aside and focus on what they do. So I think there's something to be said for waiting for that romantic love to subside a little before you make a long-term commitment. But I do think that there are ways to keep that sex life and romantic love alive. I think you can trick the brain into sustaining both in a long-term marriage.
Well, I must say I'm glad that my wife didn't put on the brakes and let the romantic love sweep aside all the faults she found in me. That was about 45 years ago. And otherwise, I mean, we got 10 grandchildren now, and that's great. And I think some of these people that get married later, they're not going to have that enjoyable phase in their life.
Well, that's true, but they're going to have a very long, enjoyable other phase.
That's true, too.
Julie in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Dr. Fisher, thank you for your insights. I'm actually reading your book, Why We Love, as I'm pondering some of the questions you've approached today. I find myself middle-aged, single, and wanting to explore a bit. It's nice to see some research on it. And I think a lot of us in this middle age, and thank you for adding it to 85, you know, we are going to be exploring and not following the boundaries our parents set up.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julie.
By the way, Julie, I wasn't going to raise this, but, you know, a year ago, Match.com, the biggest internet dating site, came to me and asked me to create a new website for them. And I did. It's called chemistry.com. It actually launches this week. And I'm actually using brain chemistry to try to get people to match up not only by sociological reasons and common interests, common background, common level of education and intelligence, et cetera, but also by chemistry. I've got a whole new theory on why it is you fall in love with one person rather than another. So you might try that site or some other kind of site because this is becoming a growing way of... what's really changing is the way that we meet people and that is different.
Now, the Internet's had a big effect on that. Now, you can send your emails to us at comments@philosophytalk.org from anywhere in the world. We've got one here from right in San Francisco, Roger Borgen. And, Ken, this is a question for you. When Ken Taylor talks about, quote, flourishing of human life, end quote, what does he mean? Can he mean anything outside of biological or economic imperatives?
No, I mean, lots of things other than biological or economic imperatives. I mean, look at your life over the long course of your life and ask yourself, Do I endorse it? Was it a well-lived life? Did I achieve the things? Was I true to myself? Did I realize my potential? Did I use my talents for things that I value? That's what I mean. And did I have a conception of myself that supported my ongoing life? I mean, lots of different things. But we have a caller on the line. Julia in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Julia.
Yes, thank you. This hasn't come up in the discussion yet. I recently heard an interview of a woman who is part of a Mormon community, and she was one of, I think, five wives, and said that it really worked to the benefit of the women. Liked the fact that they could bond and not have to bear all the burden of dealing with the man, who she admitted had to be a special kind of man. But it just made me think that, you know, your mental conditioning, she was willing to accept, you know, sharing this man, and actually said, as I said, that the women bonded and it was working well for all concerned.
Julia, thanks. You know, Helen, I read something recently that said in certain circumstances, polygamy or polygyny, I guess, is better for women, and women would prefer to be the husband of the very rich guy, the second wife of the very rich guy, than the only wife of the very poor guy.
There's no question about it that we all have trade-offs in life. But when you take a good look at a lot of societies that have this endemically, that, I mean, in other words, it's a lot of men strive for it, and it's allowed in the culture. In a great many of these societies, the women are terribly jealous of each other. Sometimes they'll kill each other's children.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, there's some people who can manage this, but we're not a species like gorillas. You know, among gorillas, if a female and a male pair up, the male has to get a second female, or the first female will leave. She will not tolerate it. Whereas in human beings, it's generally very specific circumstances. Now, among the Mormons, they've got some very strong religious attitudes about polygyny. And in parts of Africa, for example, they've got very strong economic drive for polygyny. But around the world, most people do not want to share a husband.
Helen, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you. It's been a fascinating discussion. We have too little time. We could go on and on. But thanks so much for joining us.
And happy Valentine's Day.
Okay, thanks. Our guest has been Professor Helen Fisher from the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University, author of the widely read book, Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love.
We had some really good calls today, and we had some callers we didn't get to with really good calls, and we were sorry we didn't get to you.
John, briefly, what are you thinking about monogamy and its future and its meaning?
Well, I really like this three-part theory Helen gave us, lust, attachment, romantic love, and you know, they go together and you're overwhelmed, and then sometimes they fall apart. Maybe some cultures like the swinging culture or the polygamous culture can learn to keep one from leading to the other and then cut down on the jealousy. I think it's a very powerful intellectual tool to think about the social condition of human beings in marriage.
Yeah, I think you're right, and we could explore it a lot further. I mean, there's all kinds of questions about whether we can mess with our kind of evolved psychology, how much we can change things. But, you know, this conversation continues online on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And, you know, you can now download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
Hey, John, are we at a football game? I think it's halftime. The Stanford Band's coming.
No, that drumming's not the Stanford Band, Ken. It's conundrumming.
Ah, we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Arnie.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Where are you calling from, Arnie?
From Vancouver, Washington.
Oh, terrific. What a beautiful place.
What do you do up there in Vancouver, Washington?
I'm a high school English teacher.
Oh, that's a fun thing. So why don't you tell us about your conundrum?
Well, here it is. I'm wondering if it's ethical to continue to give a person memory drugs like Namenda and Aricept when the person has lost almost all cognitive ability and yet still retains enough sense of herself to know that she can't do what she once could. The drugs probably help her retain a little bit of cognitive function, but they also probably prolong her painful loss of awareness.
Now, as I understand these drugs, they're best taken real early on when the Alzheimer's is first known about, right? And then they might extend the period before the memory loss really occurs?
That's my understanding, that they basically slow down the rate of loss, mm-hmm. but do nothing to stop it.
You're asking the question, well, now it's late in the game. The person's lost enough of their memory and cognitive functioning that they're really not the person they want to be or enjoy being. Should we continue to administer these drugs?
That's exactly the conundrum that I'm facing. Yes.
Let me ask you, what's your inclination here about this conundrum? How are you inclined to solve this, or are you equally torn on both ways?
Torn, but I'm leaning more towards stopping them.
And why are you leaning towards stopping them? What argues for stopping them?
Well, my thought is that by prolonging this period of anxiety for her, it seems less compassionate than letting the course of the disease go more quickly and probably having this period of anxiety ending.
Often, Alzheimer's goes something like this. There's the beginning of loss of memory, and at that point, it's very anxiety-producing. The person is becoming someone and fears becoming someone that they don't want to be. The end of Alzheimer's is a death that can be somewhat painful. In between there, there's this late period often where the person isn't really that unhappy. They don't really remember who they are. They may be behaving in ways that are very painful to their friends and family, but they themselves seem to be enjoying life, at least part of it, in the way a child might. And then in between there's this very stressful period, and I think that's what you're worried about, where they're cognizant enough to realize how different they are from what they want to be. They're cognizant enough to realize what a burden they're putting on and will put on their family, but they haven't made the transition into that childlike state where they're really not aware of those things and not burdened by their own past aspirations and desires. And you're saying, why prolong that painful part? Why not let them transition into the more peaceful part? It might be harder on us, but it might be easier on them. Have I got you right?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of.
Well, this is a very interesting question that comes up with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. You seem to kind of have two people. You've got the person you knew and loved who had a certain vision of themselves and what they were like, and then you have this person in front of you who's also a person, maybe not a person that's fully cognitively developed. They have desires. So take a concrete example. You've got an Alzheimer's patient who doesn't want to bathe, and their family's coming to visit them. They stink, but they don't want to bathe. You know that the person they once were would be mortified to be meeting their family in this state. And you think, do I owe it to that person to force them to get cleaned up? Or you look at this person, he's just a person who really doesn't want to bathe. What point is served by making them do something they don't want to do? Do you really have two people that you're trying to balance? I mean, just how do you think of it? It's really fraught with philosophical problems.
Yeah, how much respect do you owe the diminished person who has desires and aspirations, maybe not the same ones? How much respect do you owe that person who's there now?
Actually, for me, one of the most difficult parts of dealing with the disease is just that, making any decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, throughout our married life, we always shared decisions. And now it falls upon me to make decisions when she can no longer rationally participate.
It seems to me it's your wife we're talking about. I assume you have deep, intimate knowledge of what she would have wanted, and that your decision would be driven by not just your own comfort or discomfort or your own moral perspective, but some kind of acknowledgement of what she would have wanted for herself. And if you can make a decision based on what she would have wanted for herself, that seems to me a reasonable thing to do, you know? Yeah, unfortunately, it also seems to me a reasonable thing to do to make a decision for what the remnant of herself, as it were, wants for itself. I mean, so it's not simple, but I mean, you're onto a reasonable alternative. There may be other reasonable alternatives, but sometimes life is just complicated and you have to choose. Have we helped you at all think about this problem?
Yes, the conversation certainly does help.
Okay.
Well, thanks for joining us. I hope you, whatever choice you make, I'm sure it'll be kind, informed, you know, moral choice.
Thank you very much. I love your program.
Okay. Thanks for listening, Arnie.
Goodbye.
Bye.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear, and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley, and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, local public radio, San Francisco, where our program originated.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Thank you.